I suppose you think you're going to get to sit down and just relax and not have anything to do. Well, that myth is over. Stand up. Put up your right hand and say, I. Left hand, say, feel. Both hands, say, great. Now we're going to do it three times, but on the third one, jump as high as you can, and whoever jumps the highest, Ken Evans is going to give you a non-interest-bearing debenture for $1 million that will mature in the year 2099. I feel great. I feel great. I feel great. I think he won his own deal. I don't know if you ever heard about that before, but way back in the old days, there were savings and loans that when they went under, and you're a shareholder, they would give you a non-interest-bearing debenture which would mature 100 years after your expected end of your life. It's kind of an interesting way to solve a debt problem, right? Well, what's different about things today than one generation ago? Anybody in here have a grandmother or grandfather that you can think back 30 years ago when they were young like you are now? Anybody can do that, or is that too much to do at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? How old did men live one generation ago? That's 30 years ago. I'm glad we all agree. The average age in those days, according to the mortality table, for men was age 72. And women, age 74 in a few months. And in those days, when you were hitting age 65, they would actually have a countdown. 5, 4, 3. And they'd slap the watch on your hand and say, get out there because you only got 7 years and you're all done. That's true. Today, what's happened? One generation later, what's the average age for men? Just about. Pretty close. And women? I mean, we say 88, but now they're saying 92. Now, how does something get to be an average? I mean, if it's age 85 is the average, how did it get that way? I mean, some people live longer, some people live less, right? And not only that, this is the national average in the United States of America, which happens to include people who eat supersize me. People who aren't too concerned about their health. People who maybe had to work in coal mines. People who were drug addicts. It strikes me that there might be some drug-addicted coal miners. Supposed to be a funny joke, I don't know. But the point is, if the average person is living to age 85 male and 90 for a female, compared to the old days, how much longer is that? 25, 30 years? Now, most people think the biggest problem we have in life is growing our money. I'm not so sure that that's the case. Some people think the investment management is the big thing, the big problem of the 21st century. In the 20th century, the problem, if you had 7 years in retirement, is filling up the bucket so it had enough money in it, so when you turned on the spigot, you had enough income to pay all your bills. Because if you're only going to live in 7 years, does inflation really matter? But what happens if you're going to spend 30 years in retirement? Then what is it going to be like? What's the average rate, inflation rate, for the last 70 years in the United States? 3.5% is probably what most people would agree. Do you know, if I retired today and I needed $3,000 of income to pay my bills, and my income was $5,000, wouldn't you feel pretty comfortable if you had $2,000 more than you needed to pay your bills? Here's the problem. In 30 years, if I'm still alive, I'm 85, at 3.5%, guess how much those $3,000 worth of bills have grown to? Double? Triple? We all agree on this too, don't we? And I'm not, I am joking about this. But it's important when we go out of meetings like this to really understand what's the truth, really. The truth really is at 3.5% in 30 years, that $3,000 becomes $9,000. And if you've got $5,000 worth of income, what's your plan to get it up to $9,000 during retirement? In fact, when's the last time you've heard of somebody in your neighborhood have a financial planner call on them and teach them how they're going to triple their income during retirement. Anybody talk to you about how you're going to do that? In fact, most people don't think that they even need to worry about that. So guess what they do if their income's $5,000 and their bills are $3,000? What happens to the other two? They spend it. In fact, they borrow maybe, so they spend $6,000 a month instead of $5,000. Interesting thing, I had a lady come into my office who was retired in her early 60s, and she came to tell me that her mother had come to visit her. And her mother was 85 or 6 years of age. Her father had died 3 years earlier. And she came to tell her daughter, my client, that she was 100% out of money. Zero. And that she probably was going to have to check into a nursing home. And she came to tell her daughter how sorry she was. And they cried together. Because mom never, ever wanted to be a burden to her daughter. Never, ever wanted anything like that to happen. And she told her daughter, my client, you know, when your father and I retired, we wanted to do the safe thing. So we took our retirement, $300,000, and we put it into bonds, guaranteed income for life. Well, guess what happened? In the old days, I don't have a ticker yet, so I'm going to have to play the stairs. In the old days, when we were living to 72, 74, if your income was substantially higher than your expenses, looked pretty good, didn't it? And you lived longer and longer, which way did your expenses go? Are you there? Which way did they go? Did they go down? Were they ever level? Did they ever level off? But what happened before your expenses became greater than your income in the old days? You died. Now you move forward to today, people are living longer and longer and longer. In fact, when I was a young boy, they used to have this breakfast show. I think the guy's name was Dave Garraway or somebody like that. And they had this breakfast show down in Arizona, and they would search high and low throughout the Appalachians and the Rockies and the Wasatch Mountains. And they'd find somebody who was age 100. And they'd wheel him in at the breakfast party and say, hey, Charlie, how you doing? You're our age 100 for this month. You know what? They don't have that breakfast anymore. You want to know why? They don't have any trouble finding people over age 100. How many people do you think cashed Social Security checks in the year 2006 that were over age 100 in the United States of America? 40,000. 40,000 people. And who would you call to get that information? The Social Security Administration paid over 40,000 people last year who are over age 100. You know, it used to be the fastest growing age group was over age 85, 90, and so on. Guess what it is now? It's over age 100. So when we're talking about somebody 85, incidentally, I happen to help advise a fairly significant number of women that are average age 85 who are alone, their husbands are gone, and I don't know one of them that isn't going to live another 15 or 20 years. I mean, probably one of them won't. But the fact is, people are living longer and longer and longer. So if you keep living longer with this scenario, what's going to happen? This is what's happening today. Now, what happens when you go out to your mailbox and you've got some bills to pay and you don't have enough money to pay it? What do you do? You borrow it, but who wants to loan it to you? And you surely don't call up, in this case, the daughter and say, you know, I need some money. What happened to mom and dad is that when their bills started becoming greater than their income, they thought, well, why don't we sell a few of those bonds? And they paid their bills. And whew, we made it through this year, right? What happens to your income when you start liquidating assets? Yeah. And why she came to see her daughter is they'd finally sold all their bonds, spent all their money, and they were still alive. And here's what she said to her daughter. She said, your dad and I never expected to live so long. Never ever dreamed that it could possibly happen. Now, do you think that story I just told you only happened one time, and in McMinnville, Oregon. She didn't. She lived at home, in her own home. Thank you. What I want to say to you is that I don't want to make fun of anybody. That's not the reason for my statement. But I want to tell you something. The financial newsletters and newspapers and shows and radio and all this that have tried to convince the American public that all they need to do is have a laptop and go tappity-tap-tap and connect with the internet and read their magazines and newspapers and listen to their radio shows, and they can manage their own finances, and they don't need a trusted financial advisor like you. They've got it wrong. I don't know that I'd call it a lie, because I think you have to do that purposefully. But the truth is, the American public has been misled grossly. Because if this woman and her husband had known that the number one problem of the 21st century was inflation, would they have bought bonds? And the reality is, if you can put together enough money so that you can retire, what you have to do is to learn how to grow your money in retirement. Here's what you have to... Oh, wait a minute, I got this neat gadget. I am now in the 21st century. Dragging and scratching my way. Why didn't it work? Ha! Didn't work. Well, so much. Yeah. You got to have more than a clicker. Here's what we have to do. Let me show you these stamps. I got to bring these stamps up to date. How much is a stamp now? It wasn't long ago that it was a dime. And I've got to do this because I have two stamps that I have plastic around, and I show it to people. And I would say to them, 20 years ago, if you lived in a world where a stamp cost a dime, and you did all your investing based on stamps being a dime, how are you going to live in a 34-cent world? And people would nod and say, yeah, that's a good idea. But let me ask you this question. 20 years from now, what do you think the stamp's going to cost? At least. And if you do everything today predicated on living in a stamp that costs 41 cents, how are you going to live in a world where a stamp costs a dollar or a dollar 50? That's the problem. This is what you need to create. Notice that the income line is on the same arc as the projected rate of inflation of your expenses. Does it matter if your income after inflation and after taxes increases at least at the rate of your expenses from an inflation point of view, whether you live to be 80 or 100 or 120, if you can grow your income during retirement? Does that make sense? Now, in my locale, what would happen to people is they would go to a financial planner, and the financial planner would say something like this to them. Well, first of all, we're going to assume that you will die at age 85. So what we're going to do is set up an income stream for you so that the day that you become 85, you will spend your last dollar. And I would ask them, well, just in case, what do you do if you make it to age 86? And that's the problem with spending down assets, isn't it? Now, here's the question. How are you going to create an increasing stream of income for people during retirement? Does that look complicated? I mean, first time I looked at it, I thought, man, what kind of a Ouija board am I going to need to do that deal? And then the fella said this to me. He said, just for round numbers, Dan, let's say you had $1 million. Let's say that you had a rate of return on your total portfolio income for the year of 8.5%. 8.5% of $1 million is $85,000, right? What happens if you only take half of it as income, $42,500? How much will your principal be next year? It'll be $1 million plus the $42,500, right? No longer $1 million that you're drawing income from, but $1,042,500. Well, if you take 4% of that $42,000, you get a couple hundred a month dollar raise, right? And so if you run that out, what you find out is if you can teach people to draw half or less of the income that their assets produce, what happens to their principal? And if their principal goes up, what happens to their income? Now, when do you start this? Do you start this when you're 85, or do you start it when you retire? And when are people retiring today? You know, are they waiting to 65? Some retire at 62, some 60, some even younger. But the reality is, if you're going to have any chance to deal with controlling what happens to your life during retirement, what must you do if you may live a long life, either you or your spouse? You've got to regulate the amount of income that you take from your retirement assets, don't you? Now, here's another thing. What happens if instead of retiring at age 60 or 62 or 65, you decide to continue in some form to work for another 10 or 15 years? I mean, a lot of people say, oh, God, I don't want to do that. I hate this job. I am burned out. You ever hear anybody say that? I'm a geezer, and I talk to a lot of guys my age, and that's what they tell me. Man, I can't stand it. I don't want to go down there one more day. I hate that place. I am burned out. I'm exaggerating a little, but it sort of sounds that way. So I say this to them, well, tell me about your work. So they tell me what they do. And how much do you work? Well, I work 40, 50 hours a week, 50 weeks out of the year, maybe 40 weeks out of the year. And I say, well, let me ask you a question. Let's say I went down to your president. What's his name? Ron. What if I went down to Ron and asked Ron if he'd let you work 20 hours a week about 9 months out of the year, maybe 8.5 months out of the year? Or how would you like it if you worked 6 months out of the year and took 6 months off? Maybe not six continuous months, but a month here, a month there. You know what? The same guy that told me how much he hated his job will never go down there again. He said, I'd take that deal in a second. Why do you think there was a change of heart there? See, as people get older, they don't really want to quit, but they want some time to do the things they never had time to do. And then they'll say, oh, Ron, he'd never do that. He wouldn't do that in 100 years. I said, well, let me ask you. Would you give me permission to go down and talk to Ron? He says, it won't do you any good. Well, anyway, I went down to talk to Ron. And I said this to him. I said, I'd like to talk to you about Harry. Tell me, what does Harry mean to this company? Now, invariably, if somebody has been there for 20, 30 years and been doing a good job, the president of the company will say something like, you know what, we'll never be able to replace him. What he knows, when he goes, it goes with him. Well, I'm going to ask you a question. What if Harry was willing to work for a third of the income you're paying him now, and he just wanted to work 6 months out of the year or 24 hours a week, 9 months out of the year? You know what the president? I'd take that deal in a second. First of all, he gets to keep Harry's brain. That's what he wants. He doesn't want Harry down there for 40 hours a week. What he needs is what Harry knows, and only Harry knows it. So the amazing thing is, the other way that you help people with this income stream is if you fix a way for them to take less of their retirement or put it off until they're 70 or 75. They still get their statements, don't they? Incidentally, do you hear many financial planners talking to people about how to repot themselves from 65 to 75? In my community, we don't. And I think, you know, I heard a great word from one of your people here. Trying to remember who it was. I've heard a lot of good things from people around here, and I love it. He was telling me about his company tries to work at advocacy rather than advisor. In other words, instead of just working with the guy you're selling insurance to, how about working with the beneficiaries and be their advocate? And this is what he was telling me about. And, you know, I think that's what we're going to have to do with the planning we do, not only for the people we help, but for ourselves. You know, if we stay sharp, eat right, rest right, do some of the right things, is there any reason why if our brain works that we can't work till we're 75 or 80? And why can't we do it 20 hours a week and 6 months out of the year? I mean, why can't we be a good example to the people that we're going to be talking to? I mean, doesn't America have to wake up to the fact that we can't finance Medicare, Social Security, and everything else for another 30 years when we used to do it for five or six? I mean, it's not possible. You know, and when are we going to wake up to the fact that we're going to have to do things a little differently? But the truth of the matter is we can train people to grow their assets during retirement so that they're not like my client whose mother is 100% out of assets. Does that make sense? It doesn't make sense. Let's have a vote. That's true. But that's not their greatest concern, because remember, if they were going to quit 100%, they're going to lose them anyway. But what if they can work a schedule that makes it fun to go to work and do all the things they never got to do before and spend time with their grandchildren and earn maybe a third of what they were earning before? That means they got $40,000 in retirement to go with whatever their retirement assets would produce. Now, each person, you know, we all have a fingerprint that's nobody has the same one, right? Same thing about helping somebody with a plan. You got to come alongside people and say, you know, let's think about that. Let's work on it. Let's work on a plan that's best for you. But if we go back, if we think we're going to do this deal, is that going to work? And when will you find out you're running out of money? In the first half of retirement or the second half? And when are you least prepared to do something about it? I mean, you got no chance then. But I guarantee you, they're not going to get this from CNN or Money Magazine or some newspaper. The only way people are going to know that they've got a problem and that maybe there's a way to solve it is if what happens? Somebody like you takes it upon yourself to care enough to go out and sit down with them and say, let's work through how this could be for you. And that on that day, they're going to discover that you can be their advisor, their trusted advisor, that you can be an advocate for them. Incidentally, I usually wear my Noah tie, but it doesn't happen to match my outfit, and I have a new advisor about dress. But I used to always wear my Noah tie. And the reason I wore my Noah tie is Noah happened to build an ark, and the ark only had so many apartments in it. He could not rent out any more than the number he had. I can't be an advocate for everybody. I can only help so many people. And the tie always reminded me of that, because I knew that if I was going to do a good job for people, maybe I could take care of 200 people or 250 people. Now, the interesting thing is, if you take care of 200 people and they have $1 million in their retirement plan, that's $200 million under management. I can easily live on being an advisor with that much under management and sell some insurance and do some other things, and I can do it when I'm 70, 75, or 80. Does that make sense? Everybody hear that? It's an excellent point. I completely agree with it. My only concern about Social Security, which is even a greater concern about Medicare, but I do believe that the more that we can rely on what we're doing, the better chance we have. I always kind of put Social Security on top of what I did, not as the foundation of it. I always colored dollars green and Social Security yellow. Yellow is part green, isn't it? Isn't yellow the mixture of blue and green? Blue and yellow. Green and yellow. I'm colorblind, I don't know. Anyway, can you protect your long-term purchasing power? What's the biggest problem in retirement, we said? Inflation. What that means is, if you have the same number of dollars, but it costs three times as much for a loaf of bread, what you're really trying to do is protect your purchasing power, right? Your ability to pay your bills, purchasing power. And this is the ideal way, in my estimation, to do this. Well, a couple notes about investment maturity. What I try to do with my client is to teach them a couple few basic things so that they can understand why they need to invest. If all we had to do is to fill up the bucket until we got enough money in there so we could turn on the spigot and it had enough income to pay all our bills, it wouldn't be a problem. But the reason we have to do more than that is because expenses go up and therefore income has to go up. So the deal is, we have to invest in order to keep up with inflation. There isn't any other way. So what do we need to teach our client about investing so that they can feel some sense of comfort that they know what's going on? I have to tell you that if, knowing now what happened to the Titanic, if I went on today's Titanic, I would like you to show me how to run the rowboat before I got on. And so I tell people, if you're going to invest, you need to understand how investing works. And so I want to take you through my lifeboat drills. And if you pass, then I'll bring you into the investment. If you don't, I can't bring you into the investment. Or to say it another way, if I'm the captain of the Titanic and you don't want to learn how to run the rowboat, I can't take you on my boat. You know, on the airplane now, on the exit aisle, what do? They say, you are sitting in the exit aisle. If you're prepared to take the risk sitting in the exit aisle, good. If not, leave. You know, something like that. You guys haven't heard that one? Okay. Anyway, there's only two ways you can invest your money. Two and only two ways. You can either own something or you can loan your money to people. Can you think of any other two ways that you can invest your money? It's either ownership or loanership. Now, the way you can tell what's been sold to you is ownership or loanership is interest involved. You give it the sniff test. And if you smell interest, what do you know? It's a loan. If there's no interest, what do you know? You've got an equity possession, like buying a car, buying a piece of furniture, buying a piece of real estate. So if interest is involved, we know it's loanership, bonds, debt securities. Here we have the, what's the risk here? What's the risk if you buy bonds? What's the risk if you invest in core fixed income? Loss of purchasing power. Can you see that over there? The risk is the loss of your purchasing power. If, on the other hand, you own something, you buy some securities, some real estate, stocks, equity, what's the risk there? In fact, if you invested in the stock market today, the stock market could drop 30% in one day, couldn't it? So we could either be owners, stockholders, or bondholders, loaners. Now, in our country, people think it can be risk or no risk, risk or safety, right? The example I told you, they put all their money in bonds because they wanted to do the safe thing. What I have to tell my clients is there's no such thing as no risk. There's no such thing as no risk. If you buy fixed income, you risk loss of purchasing power. If you buy equities, you risk loss of principal. But let's examine over a long period of time, if you live a long time, especially during retirement, which is the risk that you would rather take? Here's risk of loss of principal. The minute that you buy stock or an equity, you are at 100%. That one day you could lose 10, 20, 30%. At the end of 1 year, if you look at the Standard & Poor 500, at each 5-year period since they started measuring this, you'll find that at the end of 1 year, 95% had a chance of being down, 5% were up. At the end of 5 years, each rolling 5-year period, 70% were up and 30% were down. At the end of 10 years, every 10-year rolling period, 95% were plus, only 5% of each 10-year rolling period was down. And for 15 years, there is no 15-year period in the history of the Standard & Poor 500 when it was down. In fact, after 15 years, it's a significant plus. So what you see is if you own something, if you own equities, particularly if they're highly diversified and managed and watched carefully, the loss of the risk of principal diminishes over time, doesn't it? Would you agree? Let's say that we all in this room decided to start a company and we all threw in $10,000 and we decided to sell the company at the end of 1 year. What are the odds that we'd make money selling the company? What if we did it for 5 years and sold the company? What would be the odds that we made a profit? How about 10 years? 20 years? In fact, most business owners, when they first start out, they're there 18 hours And everybody that works for them leaves at 5 o'clock, and on Friday night they're getting ready to race to the door to jump into the pickup and the trailer and head to the beach, right? But the guy that owns it, what's he doing? He's strapped. But down the road, 10, 15, 20 years, is there a reward for a successful business owner who does a good job? I mean, that's what we're talking about in equity ownership, and especially the Standard & Poor 500. I mean, if you're diversified. Well, let's look at inflation. If I went to the grocery store last week and I got a basket of groceries and compared them to what I paid the week before, what are the odds that the prices would be higher in a week? Would I notice it very much? What about in a month? And in a year? Now, one thing we know about inflation is sometimes it goes up fast, sometimes it goes up slow. But what direction does it go? Does it ever go down? Does it ever level out? So if you look at these two things, you only have two ways you can invest your money, right? You can put it into fixed income, where you have the loss of the risk of purchasing power, or you can put it in equities, where you have the loss of the risk of principal. The blue line is principal. The longer you go, the less likely you are to have the risk of the loss of principal. But what about inflation? There is no chance with inflation, is there? So if you're going to take a bet and there's no such thing as no risk, what do you want to bet on? You're going to bet on bonds, where you know for sure if you live a long life or your spouse does, you're going to lose your principal, your purchasing power? Or would you bet on ownership in high-quality companies where over time history has shown that that's a better bet, isn't it? Is there such a thing as no risk? There isn't. Now, people think so. Hey, I put my money in the bank. I got this guaranteed annuity. I got this guaranteed CD. I got this guaranteed bond. I will never lose my money. Somebody told them that. But what will they lose? Purchasing power. And which is worse? And they're asking you, you know. I mean, they listen to CNN. They read Money Magazine. They read the Wall Street Journal. They're so full of information. But do they know what to do? Are they confused? Incidentally, I met somebody out in the hall out here, and they said, why should I come hear this? I just sell insurance. The reason is you need to know this for your own family. You need to understand there's no such thing as no risk. And if you are smart about it, what kind of choices are available to you? What's the reasonable thing to do? So the question is this: can you protect your long-term purchasing power? That's what this is all about, because are we living longer and longer and longer? I think you can with equities, with stocks, with ownership, particularly if they're highly diversified and you've got large enough portfolios and you look at it as a long-term thing, not short. This is the ideal way. Now let's take a look at the last 70 years of investing. During the last 70 years, have we had good things happen in this country? Name some. Computers. What else? Cell phones. Yeah. Incidentally, are we well fed? I mean, I'm 3 or 4 meals ahead right now. I'm telling you, back when I was a kid, you had to hunt for food. Today, there's food every 3 feet, no matter where. You don't even have to open your eyes. I smell it. God, they got cookies down the hall, down here. Everybody's like, where are the cookies, you know? I mean, we have food in abundance. When I was a kid, back in the 30s and the 40s, I'm telling you, people were starving in this country. During the last 70 years, we've had the best of times and we've had the worst of times. It wasn't very long ago, my father, who was a valedictorian in high school and college, graduated 7th in his class in medical school, wanted to build a bomb shelter in our backyard because we had the risk of thermonuclear war. 1958. The people in this country were scared to death when that Sputnik first spun around this planet. And we were faced with this. 1987, million-dollar roundtable, president of New York Life Insurance Company got up and said, unless a cure is found for AIDS, My $50 billion corporation will be bankrupt by the year 2000. There have been a lot of great things that have happened in the last 70 years. There have been a lot of really difficult and bad things. 55 million people killed in the Second World War, Vietnam War, Korean War. What are we in now? You know, there have been great things, good things. There have been bad things, too. And I submit to you, because of all of the variety of good and bad things that have happened over the last 70 years, if you look at the averages over that 70 years about the difference between equities and core fixed income, it's a really good barometer about what you should be able to tell your client that they can remember and make some sense to them. So let's take a look at this. Over this 70 years, if you invested in equities in small companies, large portfolio, the average rate of return was 12.8% per year. That's the numeric rate, annual rate of return, average. If you owned stock in the Standard Poor 500s, the average was 11% every year over the last 70 years. Guess what happened if you bought the bonds in these large companies? The average rate of return was 5.8%. And if you loaned your money to the U.S. Treasury Department, the average rate of return was 5.2%. Now, what's the ratio or the multiple between being an owner and a loaner? 2-to-1. Now, what's this little gadget down here? That's inflation, the fifth number. What's the real rate of return and how does it affect your purchasing power? You've got to subtract this 3.1 from that rate of return to know how much groceries can you buy. When you do that, small company average is 9.7 per year for 70 years. Large company, 7.9. But look at this. Bonds, large corporation, 2.7. Government, 2.1. What's the multiplier now? It's 4-to-1 rather than 2-to-1. 4-to-1, the advantage historically by being an owner instead of a loaner. So what does that tell us we should do? Now, there's a right way and a wrong way to do everything, but why would you put all your money into bonds when you really aren't going to be able to make it during retirement and you may have some chance of doing it if you have ownership? Does that make sense? Now, why am I showing you this? Who do I show this to? I show it to everybody that wants to go into investments because I can't take them into my boat unless they understand the lifeboat drills. Because the problem is, if you go into ownership, we have something in ownership. If I held you up a coin and said, you know, this is a rate of return, it's 12%, guess what's written on the back of that coin if it's equity? Let's hear you say it. If you're going to invest in equity, what are you going to have? If you invest in CDs and annuities and bonds, are you going to have volatility? Not very much, are you? But if you invest in equities, you're going to have volatility. I live in Oregon. We have little ponds that you can go out and catch 12-foot fish in, or rivers you can get 12, 14, 16-foot fish. But if you go up by Alaska in the Bering Sea, you can get fish that weigh 40, 60, 80, 100 pounds. What's the difference between the conditions those fish live in? I mean, if you go into a pond, the waves are like this. But if you go to the Bering Sea, they can have swells that are 40 feet high. If you're going to send somebody out there because they want the 100-pound fish, they got to understand what the weather conditions might do to that water, right? If you say, well, listen, they got big fish up there, but the conditions are just like in the pond in your backyard. You don't have to worry. And they get up there on the day when it isn't glassy smooth. It's 40-foot swales, and they call you on the phone and say, get me out of this deal now. Do you get it? Do you understand what I'm trying to say? I want the 40, 50, 60-pound fish. I got to prepare my client for the conditions up there and put them in a boat that can stand it. There's nothing the matter with fishing in the Bering Sea, but you better not go up there in a rickety old boat, and you better not send people up there that don't know how to run the boat when they get in those kind of conditions. Because here's the deal. With volatility, are future investment results knowable? They're not knowable. Since the end of the Second World War, we've had bear markets and bull markets. What's a bear market? What they say in the textbook is a bear market is down over 20% and for over 6 months. That's sort of the definition. Now, what do you think the average down or average bear market has been since the end of the Second World War? And while you're thinking about it, we've had 12 of them. How much is the average that we have been down in those 12 bear markets? The answer is 28.6%. Now, how does something get to be an average? Was it always down 28.6? No, one time it was down 42. Now, here's the deal. Your client gets a report in the mail, and everything looks fine, down 42, but there's a little thing in front of the 42 on the statement. It's a minus sign. And you got to know how your client's going to react when they get this report in the mail and it shows minus 42%. Because if they're going to commit suicide, or worse yet, come after you with a gun, you need to know that ahead of time, don't you think? The fact is, we have bear markets every 3 to 5 years. Some of them it's down 14%, sometimes 17%. But here's the deal. Is it stayed down forever? I mean, when somebody gets a report like that, they need to know what to do, right? Just like if you get a weather report that we're going to have waves that are bigger than usual, you need to know what to do. Now, if your reaction is sell and turn paper losses into real losses and then find out 6 months later that it went back up where it was before and you just gave up a majority of your savings for life because you got scared, because you weren't prepared for the fact that we have bear markets about every 3 to 5 years, who's going to help get them through that? Are they going to get that from CNN or Money Magazine, or do they dial one of those 800 numbers and go through 39 people and say, would you please help me? I got this statement. It's got a 42 with a funny thing out in the minus, I think it is. Incidentally, do we know when the market's going down? We don't know when, but when it is going down, do we know it? Yeah, we really do. When it's going up, we're not absolutely sure because it doesn't go straight up. But when it's going down, virtually every newscaster in the nation is on the air saying, Chicken Little has fallen. We made it up before, but this is the big one. This is it. We're never going to recover from this. And they've got everybody and their brother absolutely scared to death. It's at that time that I pick up the phone. And I'm on the phone probably for 3-4 days. I call every client I have. And I say, you remember the lifeboat drills that we went through? And they say, yeah, do you think we ought to sell? Now, I want to put you through a lifeboat drill. When I show my clients that they can average maybe 4-to-1 equities versus ownership, even after inflation, but I also show them you're going to get a report every 3 to 5 years, and you're going to have a double-digit number with a little minus in front of it, but that's temporary. But I want you to repeat after me, and I'd like you to do this. No panic, no sell, no sell. No lose. No lose. You feel better now? Now, I put them through that lifeboat drill, or I won't let them invest with me. I won't take them in. You know, if you want to buy insurance products, fine. But if you want to buy investments from me, you have to go through this lifeboat drill. Now, we're downstream 3 or 4 years, and the market's dropping rapidly, and everybody in the nation is saying, man, this is the big one. This is it. So I call you on the phone, and I say, Wayne, remember 3 or 4 years ago when we went through the lifeboat drill? Yeah, I remember that. You think we should sell, Dan? No, but I want to go over that lifeboat drill with you again. Repeat after me. No panic. Come on, you guys. No sell.
No sell.
No sell.
No lose.
Do you feel a little better, Wayne? And you know what? That's exactly what happens, because they remember that we talked about the fact that every 3 to 5 years the market's going to be down to some degree, and that the average is 28.6%. But guess what? It's temporary. And here's the major point you need to know, and you need to believe this. What happens with people is if they will stay the course when the markets are down, they will get the rates of return that I showed you, 12%, 11%, that kind of rate of return. But they only get it if they do what? Stay 100% invested in the down markets. If you want the rates of return that ownership will give you, what must you do? You must stay 100% invested during the down markets. Not do anything. But if you do anything, what should you do?
Buy
more. That's where dollar cost averaging is so important, and I'd like to take a minute and talk to you about that. These are raindrop mutual funds. Out where I come from, we get a lot of rain. And on the windows, we have raindrops, and they're not all in the same places. And sometimes when we have nothing better to do, we'll play the game, and you bet which raindrop's going to fall down to the wind, the windowsill first. Now, does it matter how high up the window that the raindrop is or how low it is to know which one's going to break loose and go to the bottom? Doesn't, does it? And the same thing with investing. Do we have any idea really which mutual fund is going to do the best? If they're all managed well and they have the same kind of discipline, you know, it doesn't matter. But I'll tell you what does matter. I talk to people about buying mutual funds, and they say, yeah, Dan, which one do you buy for your family? Because you see, they figure since I'm doing this all day long every day, I wouldn't buy some dog for my family, would I? And what they do is this. They say, here, I'm going to give you a check. I want you to put this check in a mutual fund for the people I love, just in the same place that you put your money for the people that you love. What are they telling me? You see, people buy you, not the mutual fund. They believe in you. I have people say, you know, how about the Garrigus Fund? I don't know anything about it. How about the Grossman Fund? I don't know anything about it. I said, but I'll tell you the funds I do know about, and I talk to them 5 times a day. And if you're interested in investing, I'd put you in the funds that I know about where I spend my time. So I don't care about the other 14,932 mutual funds. I care about the ones that I put money into for the people I love. Would you like me to put some in for the people that you love? Makes it a little easier, doesn't it? Here we've got a client. Here we've got an advisor. I like the word advocate. How do clients fears? Do clients have fears? Hey, do you have them? How do you get from clients' fears to the faith of the advisor, the strength of the advisor, the knowledge of the advisor? How do you get there? You've got to build a bridge. Guess what the bridge is? It's trust, isn't it? How do you build trust? People are either going to go down the road to fear or to faith. Which road will you take? During your lifetime, there are 3 important issues that will affect what happens in your portfolio when it comes to investing in equities. Number 1 is asset allocation model. What's that? Balance between cash, bonds, and equities. Second thing, when equity portion of your asset allocation model drops 35%, what did you do? And how often did you change your investment portfolio? Now, the closer number 1 is to 100% in equities, and that you didn't change your investment portfolio at all, will affect your lifetime wealth. I believe you can protect your life long-term purchasing power through equities, and that you can produce an income stream like this. I show my clients something called red box, blue box. How do you make your investment decisions? Red box is emotional, hot tip, past performance, past rates of return. Blue Box is a philosophy, a process of people, of high, large portfolios. Blue Box investing is retail investing, individual positions, concentration in a few securities or mutual funds. It's reward-oriented. Short-term measures are employed. Sell on the dips. It's emotional. Blue Box investing is institutional investing. Huge portfolios, tremendous diversification. Risk management values are employed. Long-term focus. You buy on the dips. It's discipline. And I tell people, I'm in the Blue Box business, and I put a big X over the red and tell them I am not in the Red Box business. One time I did that, and this fella said, Dan, I'm going to give you $150,000 to put in the Blue Box, but I'm also going to give $100,000 to you to put in the Red Box. You know what I told him? I'm not in the Red Box business. He wanted me to buy some Intel and Microsoft. And incidentally, he did that with somebody else. And eventually, 5 years later, came back to me and he says, I got some money I want to put in my Blue Box. And incidentally, I have people call me and other people in our office and say, I want to talk to you. My CPA said I ought to see you about a Blue Box. You know, nothing about company, nothing about rate of return. You see, people need us to lean on, to give them the strength, and we've got to tell them what we believe in. People don't buy product, they buy you. And they buy what you know and what you believe in. You better decide what you believe in. Make sense? Anyway, ideal. Feeding lane. Up my way, and I'm about done. We have a cabin up on the Salmon River up on Mount Hood. It's a deli. We got beautiful mountains out of our way, but I don't know if there's any more beautiful mountains than these Wasatch Mountains. What an incredible experience being up there. But anyway, we have trout in the Salmon River. And one day, the guy said to me, he says, Dan, you know the feeding habits of a trout? Now, he was a brown trout. And I said, no. But I said, and we were standing right there by the river. The river's about 150 feet wide and about 10 miles long. And I said, if I was a brown trout, I would swim around and swim around. When I saw something that really good, man, I'd grab it. He said, well, that makes sense. He said, but if you did that and you were a brown trout, you would die. I said, really? Why is that? He said, because with all your darting around and swimming around, the amount of energy that you would use can't be replaced by the food that you're eating, so you would lose weight and eventually you would die. I said, really? I said, well, what are the feeding habits of a brown trout? He says, a brown trout will turn his nose upstream right into the current and sit in a 3-foot lane. And when food comes down that feeding lane, a foot and a half left or right, it'll attack it. But if it's even 1.5 foot off, completely will ignore it. And I thought to myself, what a great idea for business or for our profession is to figure out what our feeding lane is, to determine where are you going to position yourself? What are you going to teach people to do? When you come alongside them, are you going to try to be a master of everything? Or are you going to be a specialist and say, listen, when somebody says, I want to know about this, you say, I'm sorry, I don't know about that. Or I can tell you somebody that does, but let me tell you what I do know about. This is what I do. This is what I believe in. This is what I can help you with. I thought it was a good example. And so my question to you is, have you established your feeding lane? Moral high ground. I mentioned this morning. What are the critical variables in order for people to reach their goals? They need you, and they need a plan. Remember the cart and the horse from this morning? You know, if people don't have a plan, how do you know the product's going to help them, no matter how good the product is? Anyway, last thing I would say is this morning I mentioned to you, read your Bible. It's good stuff. Yes, Mrs. You didn't know I grew up either. Anyway, God bless you, and you've been a good audience. I hope you got something out of it.